You're listening to CHSR 97.9 FM. Welcome to This Week in Fredericton, the show that takes a deep dive into the latest news from your community. I'm your host, Zach Roman, and in this week's episode, we chat with Jane Thompson, an associate professor of law at the University of New Brunswick. Thompson is currently doing a study on the law of dependence relief in Canada and recently received a grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada for it. Thompson sat down with CHSR on August 18th to discuss her work.
I teach courses like family law, wills and estates, the law of trusts, first-year property law. I used to teach a course that was a seminar on private law theory. Maybe I will again one day. And in terms of my research, I'm very much interested in the intersection between public and private law. So for those of your listeners who don't understand what that means, and I'm sure it's lots of folks, and that's totally understandable. When we talk about public and private law are the areas of law like the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, human rights legislation, areas of the law where our legislature has decided it's not permissible to discriminate against people, to violate their freedom of religion or their freedom of expression, or their right to equality, to be free from discrimination, etc. The private law are things like contracts, wills, trusts, civil litigation. We call that the private law. And the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and human rights laws generally don't apply to those areas of the law. What I research and what I'm interested in looks at, well, what happens if somebody is using that area of the law to discriminate in a manner that they would never get away with in the public realm? And should the private law be a sheltered source, a safe place for that kind of discrimination? I say it shouldn't, and the majority of Canadian courts agree with me. And so what I study and write about is how courts deal with this particular issue. And specifically, my research looks at the area of wills, which are probably one of the most private areas of the law. What do you do with a will that says, for example, to my daughter, my estate, so long as by the time I die, she's no longer the wife of a Jew? What do you do with a will like that? How do courts deal with it? And that's a real case. It's from 1959. It's called Rehirschman. So that's basically me in a nutshell. And I have been at UMB Law now for 10 years. Before that, I taught at the University of Ottawa Law School as an adjunct professor, and I worked full-time as a private family law lawyer and in the area of wills and estates. I started private practice, I took a year off, I did my master's in law, and I'm currently finishing up my PhD in law as well, just to round it off, because why not?
Here's an overview of the law of dependence relief in Canada.
Dependence relief law also relates to my research because of how some of the decisions have played out, and I'll explain that in a minute. But the basic principles are this. Every jurisdiction in Canada has some kind of law that says if a testator fails to adequately provide for his, her, their dependents, then whoever qualifies as a dependent can challenge the will and ask a court to essentially vary the will or rewrite it. In a lot of provinces, that also counts for the laws of intestacy. The laws of intestacy apply when you die without a will. So there are intestacy acts everywhere that state. If somebody dies without a will, I don't know, their spouse gets half, their kids get a quarter. If there's no kids, if the kids die leaving a grandchild, that grandchild gets their parents' share, etc. And every jurisdiction is different. Every province and territory has a different set of laws. Some resemble one another, some don't. On top of that layer of just different statutes, we also have courts who have interpreted these provisions in very specific, particular ways to their jurisprudence. So, for example, in Saskatchewan and British Columbia, adult independent children, so these are grown-up kids who have jobs, who are not financially dependent on their parents, qualify as dependents. So if the testator fails to provide for them in his will, those kids can challenge it and say, Dad should have left me something, or Dad should have left me as much as my sister, or dad should have left me more. However, even though the language of those two statutes is almost identical, because it's very broad, it just says these people qualify as dependents. No independent child has ever succeeded in bringing a dependence relief claim in Saskatchewan. In Saskatchewan, the way that the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal has interpreted the language of their statute is that no adult independent child is likely going to be successful in bringing this claim unless they've done something crazy that would amount to an independent legal claim against the estate. Without getting too deep into it, you can sue somebody for unjust enrichment, which means you've provided some sort of service to them and they haven't paid you. And there's no legal reason why they shouldn't have paid you. Or my favorite, promissory estoppel, which is best described by the old sea shanty song, Sonny's Dream. Do you know that song?
Maybe if I heard
I'm not going to sing it in an interview, but the
it.
lines are basically it's about this guy named Sonny, and he always dreams about leaving home. But the chorus is his mother singing, Sonny, don't go away. I'm here all alone. Your daddy's a sailor who never comes home. And the nights are so long. I forget the rest of it. But the point is, there are cases of promissory estoppel where adult children have successfully sued their parents' estate because they've given up careers, marriages, independent lives, because their parent has built up an expectation that if they stay with that parent and take care of that parent, the parent will leave them all or a good portion of their estate. And so those are the conditions the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal has sort of read into their otherwise very neutral jurisprudence. You can contrast that with British Columbia, which has by far the lion's share of successful adult independent claims made by children against their parents' estate. And British Columbia is particularly interesting, and this is where it intersects with the research I was telling you about before, is that there are a handful of claims out there where kids, adult independent children, have brought these claims against their parents' estate and are alleging discrimination. So again, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, human rights legislation, it doesn't apply to wills. But nevertheless, through the vehicle of dependence relief legislation, we've got at least five decisions where children have been awarded nothing or less, clearly because of their gender or their sexual orientation. And you have the British Columbia courts responding and saying, that doesn't accord with our contemporary values as a Canadian society, and they have varied the wills. So it's really fascinating what's happening there, and I'm actually writing a paper about that right now as we speak. But the goal of this project, so my co-applicant, Adam Hoffrey Winogrado, who is a professor of law at UBC Law, and I, what our primary concern is to first provide an understanding of this law. I've sort of told you how complex it is. It's split across 13 jurisdictions, and even what's written on paper is not going to tell you what the actual law is. You have to read the cases and understand how courts have interpreted these provisions. So the last authoritative text on this subject was written in 2006, and there's been nothing since then. But since 2006, at least half of the statutes have been overhauled. A couple of them have been challenged constitutionally. Those challenges have failed, but it's notable anyway. That's 20 years. So a lot has happened. Quebec and their dependence relief is part of their civil code. And that's a newer area of the code, and it's still an emerging area of law. So, and there's nothing in the old textbook about Quebec. Also, I believe I'm going to get the date wrong, of course, but I think it was very recently, anyway, the federal government passed an omnibus piece of legislation that finally dealt with the issue of property on First Nation reserves. So this is related to family law, but they all link up. Dependence relief is actually the oldest form of family law we have, and I could tell you about its history, which is fascinating. But just to stay on this point for a minute, this law allows First Nations to create their own division of property laws because they're not subject to the division of property family statutes in the provinces because of the jurisdiction of the federal government over First Nations as defined in the Indian Act. So, with that division of property, we're also going to be looking, have any of these First Nations created statutes that resemble dependence relief? And is there a law of dependence relief that is being developed in within the different First Nations within Canada? So it's a big, ambitious project. The first step is to identify every reported decision of dependence relief since 2006. Once we have that data, then we can start understanding, formulating, explaining. The goal is to produce some academic papers on this, but also our larger goal is to update or write a new textbook that becomes the new authoritative source on this.
I asked Thompson how the law of dependence relief has been interpreted in New Brunswick.
New Brunswick's statute was amended. I don't have the exact date, but I think it was in the early 2000s. It might have even been in the 2010s. Our statute today is actually one of the broader, more liberal statutes in the country. And by that, I mean it includes a whole whack of people who qualify as dependents for the purposes of dependence relief. Some provinces limit it just to the biological children and the legally married spouse of the dead person. That one would be Nova Scotia, for example. Nova Scotia's act, while it does include adult independent children, and that's really interesting with respect to their jurisprudence, it doesn't include unadopted stepchildren. It doesn't include common law spouses. Here we do. So I used to teach this when I taught wills and estates. I would say, "Who are the dependents in New Brunswick?" And I said, "Cue the banjo music," because it's like a very long list of people that qualify. So that's really interesting. In terms of its interpretation and application in New Brunswick, I can say in one respect, at least for adult independent children, which also qualify in New Brunswick, there's five provinces where they do qualify. Until very, very recently, last year, they had a hard row to hoe, very similar to those in Saskatchewan. And that's based on a 1993 decision written by Justice Bastarache, who later went on to become justice on the Supreme Court of Canada, but he was on the New Brunswick Court of Appeal at that point. And he decided that, like the Court of Appeal for Saskatchewan, adult independent children didn't have a claim just as of right to their parents' estate. There had to be some sort of special circumstance or special need for these kids to be able to stake a claim. And the case that was decided in had some very interesting circumstances. It was a group of children who were essentially abandoned by their father when they were young and blamed him mainly for the fact that they grew up in poverty, that a lot of them were not successful in their careers. And when their father died, he left all his money to his neighbor's children, with whom he had formed a closer relationship than his own biological children. And the court upheld that. They did not vary the will. They said that happened in the past. We have to focus on what's happening now. There's no moral obligation owed to these biological children. And so that set off a string of unsuccessful cases filed by adult independent children in New Brunswick. But very recently, last year, there was a case decided by the New Brunswick Court of Appeal that changed this. And I believe it's called Anderson Estate, but regardless of the name, it's a 2025 decision of the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. And in it, the circumstances were that the testator died and he had three sons, two with his ex-wife and one with his current common law partner. The two sons of his ex-wife were left his estate in the will. His much younger son, who was still an adult by the time all of this happened, so he qualified as an independent adult, was left the proceeds of a life insurance policy, which I believe was around $250,000. The estate was worth $2 million. The background facts were that the testator, like Curry, had basically paid no financial support to his sons from his previous marriage, and there was a sort of agreement between him and his ex that he would instead leave them his estate in the will. The third son was working, he had a job, he was had been left $250,000, but nevertheless, he applied for dependence relief. And the Court of Appeal agreed. And they said, despite this agreement with the ex-wife, despite that this child had been left something, they said, given the size of the estate, there was a moral obligation for the testator to provide better for his third son than what he had done. And they varied the will. They didn't split it evenly, but they gave him more money. And I recently published a paper about that decision, and I signaled that this could be a turning point for New Brunswick. The culture and the interpretation of dependence relief might be changing here in light of this decision. We're just going to have to see if we become more like British Columbia and less like Saskatchewan.
There's a wide range of opinions on the law of dependence relief in Canada.
And it's a huge controversial point. This angers and upsets many people who really believe that adult independent children should have no claim to their parents' estate. And that's a perfectly valid belief. The way that I approach this is, sure, and that's the law in at least half of Canada, in Ontario, in Prince Edward Island, Manitoba, Alberta. These claimants have no legal foothold. They don't. They've tried. They're barred by way of statute. And it's open to the legislatures of any province to do so as well. Interestingly enough, though, Wally Opal, who used to be the Attorney General of BC, was asked this question, and he said, we left it in there precisely to stop what was going on, particularly with certain cultures of completely discriminating against the female children in their families. They said, we did that on purpose. That's legislative policy, and we stand by it. So the BC cases that I was talking about before, there are at least three of them that involve families where the lion's share of the estate was left to the sons, even though the daughters arguably had independent claims, like I told you before, unjust enrichment, promissory estoppel. Those daughters were doing that. They were taking care of their parents when they were dying, when they were elderly and sick. They were dutiful children throughout the entire lifespan of their parents. Whereas in some of these cases, the sons did little, nothing, were living in a different country or a different province. And nevertheless, you have, in one case, an estate worth $7 million, where the two sons got everything and the four daughters got $100,000 each. But you have to think this is a private will, this is a private matter, and the Charter of Rights doesn't apply. Human rights legislation doesn't apply. So what are we to do? And the court's answer to that was, we are going to do something because it's how they interpret British Columbia's statute and how they've applied it. And without going too deep down a wormhole, although this is, I could talk about this all day because this is what I write about, you have to look at the test that's been developed in BC because their statute is probably the broadest of any, that it contains no factors for a court to consider. It just says, has the testator made adequate provision, yes or no? And so they have a test. They talk about, is the reason, did they provide a reason why they disinherited or they left a child nothing? Is that reason valid? Is it rational? And those are the hooks where they get into talking about this isn't rational. This isn't valid. Look at the facts. Look at all the things that the daughters did. Anyway, they're fascinating cases. I don't think enough has been written about them.
If you're just tuning in, welcome to This Week in Fredericton, the show that takes a deep dive into the latest news from your community. Today, we're chatting with Jane Thompson, an associate professor of law at the University of New Brunswick, about her study on the law of dependence relief in Canada.
Once we have all of these cases identified, we're going to code them and classify them in a way that reveals patterns or insights into what is actually happening on the ground in Canada. So we have three research assistants that we've hired, and they are getting going. They have a giant Excel page to start with about 20 different categories. So their job is to be the first readers of these decisions and to tick off boxes. And just some of the boxes are, jurisdiction, year, etc., but also sex of the applicant, sex of the deceased, relationship to the deceased. Is the religion, the race, the ethnicity of the family an issue? Because sometimes it is. In all of the BC cases I told you about, they were Indian families or Chinese Canadian families, recent immigrant families. And so there appears to be a correlation there. What, were they successful? Were they not successful? Why were they not successful? Did the court consider financial need? Interestingly, only Manitoba statute requires that a dependent be in financial need in order to make one of these claims. Everywhere else, it's not that, it's not a matter of that. It's more a matter of your moral obligations to provide for your dependents. So we're just trying to see what's out there, if it's codifiable. I'm pretty sure it is, and what emerges. It's at its infancy right now, so I can't really speak to what we're gonna find. I have some theories, but we'll have to see.
Knowing the history of dependence relief can be important to understanding it today.
So dependence relief is the oldest family law that we have. It came about at the turn of the 20th century. It originated in New Zealand, and it was a result of women's groups in New Zealand lobbying the government to secure financial security for widows. Because at that time, and this is another area of my research, but at the time, the trend in wills was to leave your wife with a life estate, which means she gets to use all of your property for so long as she lives, and then when she dies, everything would go to your eldest son. Just to put some salt in that wound, the other common thing to do was to say to my wife for life, so long as she does not remarry. If she remarries, she loses everything immediately, goes to my eldest son. You have to understand that back then, a lot of women in the Commonwealth countries were operating under what is called the laws of coverture. This goes back a while, but coverture meant that when you married as a woman, your legal personality was subsumed into your husband's. You no longer were legally a person. That's what the person's case was about. Along with that, when all of the property that you owned, any property that you owned when you married became legally the property of your husband, even if you divorced him, it remained his property. Although it's very hard to get a divorce, you needed an act of parliament in those days to get divorced. If he died, it was still his property. So he willed away his property, which might used to have been yours, any way he liked. Furthermore, there was no such thing as division of property or the idea that work inside the home was of equal value to work outside the home. Those statutes didn't arrive in Canada until the late 70s, early 80s. And so women worked alongside their husbands to amass the fortunes of their families, or not the fortunes, but to survive. Whatever property was accumulated during a marriage, although the product of both of their labor, again, rested solely in the husband's name. And when these men died, at best, the women got a life estate. The suffragette movement in New Zealand was like, this is ridiculous. You know, I didn't have 13 children and live on this farmstead and have five of them die in infancy and work hard labor with my husband to be left with no financial security and no control over this farmstead. And so the governments agreed, and the first dependence relief acts were executed in that country. They came over to Canada starting in the prairies, I believe. I think Alberta was the first one, might have been BC, for the same reason. And Justice McLaughlin, Chief Justice McLaughlin, in a case called Tataryn versus Tataryn in 1996, talks about this history. And she makes it clear in that decision that this wasn't just about financial need. It was about dignity and equality and the independence of women in Canada. And it was the first kind of statute that we saw that allowed a court to move property back over to the wife. To say, no, she's not going to have a life estate. She has the fee simple. Those are property terms, but it means that you own it. And when you die, you decide what happens to it. It means you can sell it free of encumbrances. You don't have to worry about explaining, well, this is actually tied to my life, so I'm selling it to you, but when I die, your interest in it evaporates. And it was the first form of power that women had or agency through the law over their own property. So they're incredibly important. Lots of people don't know about them, but they were the first kind of family law that we had in Canada. And that's another reason why I'm so interested in them. People used to think that the family was a private thing, that you couldn't have laws about families. You know, a man's family was his domain. He was, this is legal language, he was the baron, and the woman was covered. A femme couverte, that's where coverture comes from. She was covered by her baron. And the nicest version of that is that he was solely responsible for her. But the most sinister version is that her life was in his hands. He could do whatever he wanted. Children were property until the 70s, really. 1979, the year I was born, the United Nations declared it the year of the child, where they said, you know what? I think these little creatures might be human. They might actually, oh God, I think they might have rights. I think they might not be property. I think that maybe, and then family courts begin to think, well, maybe they don't automatically go to their mother until they're 8 and then switch to their father after 8 with no regard to their development or which of the parents would provide a better home for them. Like that all happened in the late 70s, early
Wow.
80s, right? I also, so you can see sort of why trusts, wills and estates, family law, property, they're all related. And somebody who's unfamiliar with the law or a first-year law student who's going to come in and they want to change the world might think, I'm going to study constitutional law, I'm going to study the charter, I'm going to help people. Well, actually, it's in every facet of the law. You just have to look. And a lot of the most interesting work are in the areas of the law where public law doesn't apply at all, but there remain, quote unquote, public law issues.
Thanks for listening to This Week in Fredericton, the show that's dedicated to bringing Fredericton residents news about their community and the people that shape it. We're on the air every Friday from 11:30 a.m. to noon, right here on CHSR 97.9 FM. Each week's episode is also posted in full on our website, chsrfm.ca. If you have a news tip, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by email at news@chsrfm.ca. I'm Zach Roman, and that was This Week in Fredericton.